The main topic of Parshas Behar are the laws of Shemitah, the laws of Yovel, the seventh year, the Jubilee year. And within this section, we find the following Pesukim, verse 35. If your brother becomes impoverished and his means falter in your proximity, you shall strengthen him, prostrate a residence so he can live with you. Do not take from him interest and increase, and you shall fear your God, and let your brother live with you. Do not give him money for interest, and not give your food for increase. For I am Hashem your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt, to give you the land of Canaan, to be a God unto you. And we know, as the Ar Scrolls points out in Source 2, that Neshech and Tarbib, interest and increase, these two terms are synonymous. It's a prohibition against interest, is mentioned twice, so that those who charge or pay it are in violation of the two commandments. So there's a problem in charging interest, and there's a problem as well in paying interest. Ve'aretem elokecha, you shall fear your God. Without this fear, it would be difficult to restrain someone from taking interest, because it seems reasonable to receive something in return for the use of one's money. And indeed, as Hema Yinachamunim, the Talmud Rebbe notes in source number 3, that is indeed our first question for today. Is it not really reasonable for a person who has a certain amount of money, that if they're going to lend their money, that they should make money on it, right? They put it into the bank, they make money on it, so why shouldn't they just lend it to somebody? They also should make money on it. So how do we understand the Torah's prohibition that if somebody lends money to somebody else, you're not allowed to make any money on it, you just have to lend it? It seems to be really unfair. How do we understand this whole halacha on, you know, the level that we can understand? Obviously we don't understand. That's question one. Question two is context. Why do we find this halacha within the laws of Shemitah? And in particular, why does the Chumash end, I'm the God who took you out of Egypt? What does coming out of Egypt have anything to do with not charging interest? So before we even begin, we'll have two points of introduction, and then we will look at this on a number of levels in Ritz Hashem. The Ner Uziel, Rav Uziel Mulevsky Zatzal, points out the following. Although taking interest, source 4, is prohibited outright, the oral Torah does allow for certain quote-unquote loopholes that enable one to charge a fellow Jew for money he borrows. One method is to lend with a heter iska, a transaction permit that makes the lender a partner of the borrower. The money the lender earns on the loan is then considered profit rather than interest. And most banks in Israel have a heter iska, and there is a real challenge with a heter iska that people, if they become a partner, can easily lose the capital as well, because it's a 50-50. Another way is to lend the money with interest to a non-Jew, so a lender with interest to the Jew who wishes to borrow. What's the purpose of issuing an outright prohibition if the Torah allows ways to circumvent it? Torah economics are a unique blend of free market capitalism and elements of socialism that are concerned with the welfare of the less fortunate. The Torah does not differentiate between a rich Jew and a poor Jew. According to the letter of the law, charging interest to either of them is prohibited. However, the Torah does want, and that's why there are exceptions, have a smooth-running society, and that's why there are ways to lend money that people can invest, etc. If someone takes advantage of either of these loopholes to charge interest to a Jew in need who must borrow money, that person blatantly violates the spirit of the law. This is why Torah issues an unequivocal warning. If your brother grows impoverished and loses the ability to support himself, do not take advance or cured interest from him. Fear your God. God alone knows what's in your heart. So first introduction is that although we are not allowed to charge interest, there are loopholes, and that we know that you're allowed to charge interest to a non-Jew, right? Shakespeare, we've seen Jewish history, that the Jews were the money lenders. And so if you lend it to a non-Jew who then lends it to a Jew, that's a loophole. And Heter Iska, the special arrangement, is also another one. Although technically, according to the letter of the law, if someone comes over to you and says, I'm just not making it, can I just have a loan? You should loan them the money without any interest. The second idea that we'll just use as our overall is to understand that in the area of business ethics, there is this idea, as Rav Pam points out in the introduction to the book on Ribbis, as we'll mention later, Mirza Hashem, that one of the first questions that's asked to a person after 120 years, the first question asked is, Nasata v'natata b'emuna, did you conduct your business affairs with faith? Then we're asked, did you set time for Torah study? Did you anticipate the redemption, etc. There's another Gemara which says that the first thing that we are judged for, that the retribution is for, is Torah study. So Tosfos asks, so which one is it? Is it for honest business dealings, or is it for Torah study? Tosfos then explains that while in judgment, business conduct takes precedence over Torah study, retribution is in a different sequence. Punishment for neglecting Torah study comes first. The reason? The cause of a person's misconduct in business is a lack of proper knowledge of Torah and a lack of loyalty to its teaching. And this is really what we need to understand. We're going to be talking about the laws of Ribbis today, Mirtz Hashem. We're going to talk about the construct, and then we'll end with a few very concrete examples. The laws of interest of Ribbis, Ribbit, are very, very complex, are very numerous, and most of us are really unaware of so many of these laws. So to say, well, I didn't know about them, is really no excuse when there are books there to learn. To say that I'm in the process of learning, thinking, hold true of Hilchos Shabbos, and of so many areas, that you have to realize that if there are these, books available, that we need to avail of ourselves of these things. And we have to keep in mind that when we're dealing with business ethics, and this is something Rav Palm speaks about very clearly on the back of the first page in source number 7, he quotes here the Chafetz Chaim that a God-fearing man entering the field of commerce is obliged to carefully study the second section of Chosur Mishpat, which deals with monetary matters, especially those halachas dealing with cheating and the possibility of an error in sale. Just as a shochet is obligated to learn the laws of ritual slaughter, and a sofer and the expert in Torah script, a merchant must be equally proficient in the halachas pertaining to his profession. It would be wonderful, says Rav Palm, if just as ordination is granted to rabbis to permit them to enter the rabbinate, so too would some form of smicha in the laws of commerce be instituted for people entering the business field. In another sefer that we're to mention today, Ribbis Brura, he says in the introduction that really women should be learning this just as much as men, because very often we know in today's day and age, women go out into the business world, and as we'll see, women are borrowing things from each other all the time. And a lot of the laws of Ribbis apply. So just as we teach in the curriculum our students the laws of Shabbos and the laws of Kashrus and the laws of Brachos, there should be as well at least the basic rubric in business of Chosur Mishpat, of what you do in different situations so that you know that you're not cheating, that you're being honest. And this applies to babysitting, applies to everything, you know. We're in all areas of anybody who is hired, anyone who's in business, whether you are working for somebody, you're the owner, there are so many laws. You're an employee, there are so many laws that apply that we have to be well aware and we have to be well versed, and unfortunately, we're not. Just to give some examples, in source number 8, when selling an item, a person must be very careful that does not have any flaw in it or that it be lacking in any way. And if it should be flawed, he must notify the would-be purchaser in advance, for does not, the sale may be invalid. Another example, source 9. Similarly, when examining an article, one must be careful not to damage it in any way. When people purchase a lulav and they examine it for defects, such as a split down the spine, they may well cause a split by examining it carelessly and then say, I don't want this one, let me see another one. This is a common occurrence and one should be exceptionally careful about it. You know, to move it into the realm of women, maybe checking a lulav is not a very practical example. We have this when we try on different clothes, right? Versus wearing makeup, and the makeup gets on the clothes that we're trying on. So are we responsible for those, you know, for the damage we've done for this item? Or you try something on, you think it's your size, and you find out the hard way it's not your size, and the button pops. Are you responsible to buy this? Are you? What do you do in such a case? Can the person working there say, oh, don't worry about it if they're not the owner? Maybe the owner would worry about it. These are so many areas that come up all the time where we're in these type of situations where we may have damaged something inadvertently. To what extent are we responsible for it? What accountability and accountability do we have? And these are the questions that we have to be at least aware of and ask ourselves these questions and not just, you know, put it back on the shelf and pretend that, you know, we got nowhere near it. There's accountability and responsibility for our actions. And this is why learning the laws of Chosur Mishpat is crucial and do something that if it was not taught, that we should, depending on obviously what field we're in, we should be learning this. Let's take a look at specifically at Ribbis, at not charging interest. And what I'd like to try to do, Mirza Hashem, today is take a look at the philosophical construct, and we'll take a look at it with three levels with God's help. We'll take a look at it, Ben Adam L'Makom, between man and God, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and one's fellow man, and Ben Adam L'Atzom, between man and oneself. We'll see how in each case it fits into the context, particularly, I'm the God who took you out of Egypt. And then at the end of this year, we'll just give some practical examples of how Ribbis, how interest applies to our lives, albeit we may not have capital to loan to somebody else, but there's so many different areas that come in that really creep into our lives. And we'll end with that, just not to teach halacha here, because that's not our intention, but rather just to be aware of the things that we need to ask and we need to be aware of. So let's start. Ben Adam L'Makom, why can't we charge interest? It's our money. Let's make money on the money. So Drash David in Rav David Hofstadter notes the following. He quotes our Gemara that when a person is brought to heavenly judgment, the court's opening question is, have you conducted your business dealings faithfully? This begs the question. There are numerous mitzvahs in the Torah that would seem to be much greater significance than how one conducted one's business. And also, the use of be'emunah, nasata ve'natata be'emunah, is also fascinating. It doesn't use the word be'emes, honestly, or be'yosher, with integrity. What does be'emunah, faithfully, mean? So he says, we propose that the question in the asterisk, have you conducted your business dealings faithfully, does not refer exclusively to honesty versus deceit, or integrity versus crookedness, rather refers to faithfulness in Hashem. Have you placed your faith in Hashem even while plying your trade? Have you conducted your business with emunah in Hashem and bitachon that He is the source of all success? For that is the foundation of dealing honestly with integrity. Only one who truly believes that the divine providence directs and guides every aspect of each individual life, who feels not the slightest doubt that everything he owns has been presented to him by the Creator, who recognizes that each success and failure are in the hands of Hashem and are not dependent on his own involvement, only a person with that level of faith can conduct his business dealings honestly and with integrity. Such a person will never attempt to deceive his fellow, for he will never think to take anything that does not clearly and indisputably belong to him. And this explains, he notes, the Siach Yitzchak, who points out that when it talks about having false weights and measures in commerce, it uses the terminology that one who does so is an abomination to Hashem, which is the same language used for one who serves a avodah zarah for idolatry. Isn't that fascinating? And the answer is no. I mean, yes, but no. One who is deceitful in the bracket in commercial matters similarly denies the divine providence which directs the worlds, that Hashem sustains and supports every creature, from the largest to the smallest. Accordingly, someone engaged in wrongful practices perforce thinks that everything he earns is totally dependent on his sharpness of his own actions, that by deceiving his fellow and stealing from him, he'll increase his personal wealth. He's truly like an idolater, for his kochi votzim yadiya sali techeil is there, the power and the strength of his hand are the objects of his worship. Thus, we see that a lack of integrity in business dealings is indicative, really, of a lack of a faith in Hashem. Nasata v'natata be'emuna. The first question we have to ask ourselves, albeit we're talking specifically about ribbis here, about interest, not charging interest, but it's really true, everything we're going to say today, Mirza Hashem, across the board, that we have to understand that our business dealings, first and foremost, that money is a gift from God, and that every single thing we have belongs to Him, and He appropriates to every person. Nasata v'natata b'emuna, do you act with a sense of emuna, with a sense of faith in Hashem? Now we can clearly appreciate the idea of why this is found specifically in the section of Shemitah, source 13b. What is the whole idea of Shemitah and Yovel about? It's about to recognize that the land doesn't belong to us, it belongs to Hashem. And that Hashem has the ability to sustain us, even in Yovel. We take off the 49th year and the 50th year, not working the ground for 2 years straight. Like, what is the person going to eat? If Hashem, if one understands Hashem, it's the one who sustains us. So whether we work the land or we don't work the land, this is the premise that Hashem gives us, then He will take care of us. And that's why the Chazon Ish writes in his tractate, in his treatise, Emunah Bitachon, in the asterisks in 13b, do not be worried if someone else opens a store to compete with yours. Instead, make an effort to help him succeed. Offer him useful advice. Do whatever might benefit his endeavor. This is what the laws of Shemitah and Yovel teach us. This is what Ribbis teaches us. It teaches us that Hashem appropriates to every single person exactly what they need. And therefore, a person, why are the laws of not charging interest in the laws of Shemitah and Yovel to teach a person that you may think that, oh my gosh, if I don't, you know, lend money with interest, I'm losing money. Remember that Hashem, who's the one who takes care of people in the years of Shemitah and Yovel, will take care of you, and in no way will you lose out on the capital of money. And therefore, we can understand the end of 14, where the Torah juxtaposes the prohibition of monetary deceit and lending money with interest for the mitzvahs of Shemitah and Yovel. The fundamental concepts that they teach are one and the same. We must continuously reinforce our emunah and bitachon on Hashem, must constantly remember that whatever exists is His. This reinforcement will bring us to scrupulous honesty with regard to both other people's money and our own business ethics. It will train us to avoid any trace of deceit, any tinge of theft, any hint of dishonesty. It will also encourage us to see our own assets, to assist others, for we'll truly understand and internalize that everything is His, and that it is His will that we share what He's given us with others. For all the root of all the mitzvahs we have discussed are emunah and bitachon in Hashem. And indeed, as the Mishnah Shechem and Rav Kaufman Zal points out in Source 15, this is, and it's quoted by a lot of the Mefarshim, this is the understanding of the Klal Yikar, of why we're not allowed to charge interest. The Klal Yikar says so clearly, Ki ikar tam isar ribit hi shelufi shu meser midat bitachon mina otam. Why can't we charge interest? Because it takes away faith in a person. Usually in business, you turn to Hashem to help you out. Will I make a profit? Will I not? But if someone gives charges with interest, so you think the profit is there, it's made in the bag, made in the shade, and therefore you turn away from turning to Hashem, and you're relying on another person. This is why you're not allowed to charge interest. Says the Klal Yikar, interest by definition takes you away from total dependence on God, and you think that your money is going to be made by your own efforts. And this is why the Klal Yikar points out you're allowed to charge interest to a non-Jew. Because with a non-Jew, you never can be sure you can get your money back. And since you never have that surety, right? They make up excuses, they make up laws, whatever it is, right? Not saying that all non-Jews aren't honest. But throughout history, we've seen too many edicts against Jews to know that when you lend money to a non-Jew, you have to be worried, will I get it back or not? So since there's that element of emunah bitachon that you're worried and you're davening to Hashem, I hope I get my money back, so you can charge interest because you're already davening to Hashem. Unlike with a Jew where you have, hopefully, that sense of feeling that this person is honest and you'll get your money back. Therefore, you've taken away all elements of emunah bitachon. That explains the Al-Shech HaKadosh, why specifically Hashem mentions here, I've taken you out of Egypt. Because what was the experience of Egypt? So one aspect was that everything was l'malu min ha-teva. That you understood that there's nothing natural. That, you know, water turns into blood and frogs. Nothing was natural. And that's how you have to understand life. We look at life, and particularly commerce, so often as A equals B, B equals C. It has nothing to do with it. God who took us out of Egypt, and, you know, hail can come and snow in Mitzrayim, it makes absolutely no sense. This is the way we have to understand that the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu appropriates money is from His cheshbon and not from our cheshbon, from His accounting, not from ours, and we have to understand that just like God who took us out of Egypt, nothing is really according to, so to speak, the natural cause and effect. We have to understand this as well. Just to take this idea one step further, in 16a, he points out that the Baal HaTurim notes that the word neshech, which is interest, is the same word, really, as nachash, the same gematria, same numerical value, as snake. In what way does the snake have to do with one who charges interest? So there are a number of common denominators. One of them that he points out in 17 is As we just mentioned, a person who lends with interest is removing their faith from God and putting their complete faith in the person who they gave money to. And they go, and he walks around feeling very confident that he's going to make money on this. And he doesn't have to worry at all. And that, my friends, is the same thing as the snake. We know the snake is Lolam in the Arrow 16B, and on Yisrach Lechastei Hashem Yitbarach Vezrato, Ve'nosam Miftacho V'lo Tole Einav Bo Klal. The snake never turns to God for help. The dust is ubiquitous. It eats wherever it is. It never has to turn to God. And that was part of its punishment. Hashem says, I don't want to hear from you ever again. You have all your food that you need. Just stay away from me. So in a certain degree, the snake has the same characteristic as this person who says, God, you know, right now, I don't need you. You can, you know, we can take a vacation from each other for a while. And I can rely on people down here. It is falling into the trap of the snake, where we have to understand that we are totally dependent on Hashem at every single moment, and that's what this mitzvah comes to teach us. And this is so beautifully described in source 18 in the bracket from the Orchos Chaim Laharash. He says we should liftoch b'Hashem echol avavcha. We should believe in Hashem with our whole heart. And believe in Hashkacha Prati. And in that way, we have to really believe that Hashem's eyes are throughout the land and grants every single person exactly what they need when they need it. And he points out in 19 that this explains the one bracha in the Birkas HaShachar, the morning blessings, that's said in the singular. Most of the blessings are Pokeh Ivrim, Hashem opens the eyes of the blind, plural. Matir Asurim, He unbounds those who are tied. Everything's in the plural. Zovkeh Kfufim. The one bracha that's in the singular is Sha'asa Li Kol Tzarki, that Hashem has given me all that I need. And that is so fundamental for each and every one of us to think about that bracha and to pause every morning. Hashem gives me exactly what I need, when I need it, how I need it. And indeed, as the Chovos Levavos points out, He knows what I need more than what I know what I need. And therefore, I have to know that whatever I need will be given to me when I need it, because the one who knows what I need will ensure that what I need will be given to me when I need it. Which makes somewhat sense to me, at least. I need to think about that one too. So this is the bracha, Shasali Kol Tzarki. Hashem gives me what I need. Hashem gives every person where they're at. This is the idea of Ben Adam L'Makom, that we have to understand, why don't I, am I allowed to charge interest? Because it takes away, it undermines that relationship that I have with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is so beautiful, which is so dynamic, which is at every single moment that I'm not assured of anything, and I always have to turn upward to Hashem, the man given every day, to turn to Hashem for faith. And this is why he notes in 21, the two psukim that should be on your lips at all times are Hashem Sfakoni Manu, Hashem is with me, Miskav Lano, He's my fortress, Elokei Yaakov Sela, the God of Yaakov, and Hashem Sfakor Ashrei Adam Boteach Bach, Hashem is my God, praise is the one who continuously relies on Hashem. These psukim talk about the Yisodos Hamuna V'Bitachon, L'Ro Livnei Adam Shashem Imanu Tamid, that Hashem is with us at all times. He never leaves us for a minute. And we can rely on Him at all times. Now, just to end this first level, it is important to note, as Rav Druk points out in Source 22, that a person can use what we've spoken about, how you have to rely on Hashem, and Hashem takes care of everybody, and Shasali Kol Tzarki, and that when a person comes to our door and says, you know, I need money, a person can give them this whole Musar Shmuz that we just spoke about for the last 2 minutes. Don't worry, say the bracha Shasali Kol Tzarki with Kavana, Hashem gives you what you need, you don't have to borrow money from me, just turn to Hashem. No. When it comes to giving money, we don't give people Musar Shmuzes, right? If we have the opportunity to help somebody out, We have to do that. As the people say at the end of 22, that the Gashma Shela Shaniz Aruch Nitchali, the physical welfare, well-being of somebody else is my spirituality. I have to make sure to take care of that. So when we speak about how important it is to have emunah and bitachon, this is not something that we can put on somebody else. This is about our own business relationships with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. That, my friends, is level number one. Why can't we charge interest? Because interest takes away from my reliance on the Kodesh Baruch Hu, similar to the nachash, similar to the snake. We have to recognize that Hashem is taking care of us, that it's in the section of Emunah Bitachon of the Shemitah and Yovel. Hashem changes the natural order of Mitzrayim, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu is watching over us and doing what needs to be done at all times. That's level one. Level two, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. What do we learn? Why we can't charge interest? So Rav Pan points out, 23, this pasuk is a source of the Torah for the mitzvah of stucca. While most Jews are generous and caring, and quote-unquote bend over backward to help their brethren in the time of need, there are those who have a cynical attitude towards tzedakah recipients. Let them go out and work, they say. Why are they so lazy? Such remarks are sometimes heard from those who resist parting with their hard-earned money to assist their impoverished fellow Jews. When the Chafetz Chaim would hear such comments, he would respond by saying, and this is important, not that I'm accusing anyone here, God forbid, of making such comments, but perhaps you've heard such comments, and it's important to listen to the Chafetz Chaim, and then nicely, without, you know, refer these people to this comment. The Gemara Nida 16b says that at the time of a person's conception, it is decreed in heaven whether he'll be rich or poor. If his destiny is to be poor, then Hashem must give him the tools to fulfill his task in life. A poor person frequently lacks the ambition and drive to succeed. His quote-unquote bones are heavy, and he may be a shlemazel who lacks the natural ability to earn money. It's not necessarily his fault, and therefore it's unfair to say that he's collecting money because he's too lazy to work. This is all part of the divine decree on this person that he be a pauper. How can he be blamed for his sluggishness in trying to earn a living? Therefore, those whom Hashem has blessed with wealth should take this factor into account and deal benevolently with the needy. And indeed, this is what is spoken about. Rav Reich speaks about this idea of Ose Kulam Hashem and Meir Einehem Einei Shneim Hashem, that Hashem is the one who enlightens the eyes of both of them, and Hashem orchestrates the way the two are going to come together. And he says, Kevan Shakol on the arrow in 24, since we all need help from above, there's something very important to recognize here. Hashem opens the eyes of both of them. Hashem's divine favor and love comes to both of them. When both the rich and the poor are able to connect together. Not when each one lives their own individual lives. I mean, believe it or not, chashev olamos shel re'eihu, thinking of the other person. The rich person only has money because Hashem wants him to be the one who's going to be giving the poor person money. So if the poor, rich person wants to continue Siyata D'Shmaya, help from above, to continue to have the assets he has, they're really given to him on condition of giving it to somebody else. And that's why the rich person should understand that the way he receives, or she receives, the Siyata D'Shmaya, the Haraspanim, the grace from above, is by sharing, is by giving, is by being able to connect with a poor person. And he goes on to by saying, he says, this is Pshat in the Pasuk, in 25, Ki amuch achicho matei yado imach, if your brother becomes impoverished, and his hand becomes weakened with you, im lechan nisbamein lifgosh b'achicho amach, if Hashkacha, divine providence, wanted you to meet this poor person, hareza o me'ashamayim, it's a sign from heaven, ki b'kochecha lo shio lachzik bo, that you have the ability to help them. And if you, God forbid, ignore them, it is so easy to have the wheel turned, lo aleinu. And I'll tell you, my friends, and this is why it's called Stucca. It's tzedek. It's righteous. I'll tell you, my friends, when we're talking about Richard Bourjard, even though we are talking about ribbis, we're talking about monetary aspect, it's clear in the Sfarim that we're referring to all people who are blessed with whatever they are blessed with. And a poor person is somebody in need, and it's not necessarily monetary need. Someone may be very good in terms of giving advice. So they're the rich person, and a person who needs the advice, they're the poor person. Some person may be very good in giving a spiritual boost to people, like, you know, really building up somebody in a difficult time. They're the rich person, and the person in need is the poor person. Whatever strength that you have, whatever koach that you have, that means you're the rich person. You were wired, so to speak, with this set of abilities, and the poor person was wired or put in situations that you have the ability to be able to give them and you be able to help them. So you can follow the piece that the Talmud Rebbe adds to this. I never met this before. He quotes the Chazon Ish in his Sefer Amun and Bitachon. And the Chazon Ish says, this is 26, very fascinating. He says, even though today we don't have Nevuah, and we don't have Ruach HaKodesh, right? We don't have divine prophecy, etc. We're living the time of Hester Panim. The Chazon Ish, your line of third line 26, and for the last, the asterisk Hashem left for us, Giluyim Marishim Shal Hashkacha Pratit. He left us very clear aspects of Hashkacha Pratit. Shemeshamesh lanu tachlit lo tolum oftim, that form for us a substitute for the miracles of Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah. Many times a person sees in their lives one event after another event. A person who's a maimin, v'adam ha-mamin yodea l'kasher tziruf ha-mikrim hazel l'shkacha prati, is able to see clearly A, B, C, D is happening. This is clearly the divine hand. Ha-mishamesha kishirayim l'nevuah sholtam ha-yamim. This is our leftovers. Right? We don't have prophecy. We don't have Ruach HaKodesh. But we do have shkacha prati. We do have like an echo, a sense of divine providence, of Hashem, deep involvement. And that's why he says in 27, the Torah is not just a chukim yavesh, it's not just sefer, a book of dry laws. It's Torah's chayim, it's a book of life. It's a Torah of life. And he says, therefore, al adam ladat ki hamifgash beino levein chaveiro, when one person who's rich, and again I use rich in the global sense, and a person who's poor, again in the global sense, notzer bashkacha pratit al yonah mechuvena bina pechikcha, Hashem, with open eyes, has made it that these two people will meet. Shanitrech hazeh yekabel manatein hazeh, that this rich person will give to this poor person. This is not just, oh, they happen to knock on their door. There's no such happens to knock here. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gam kaval shebisha plonit umakom plonit diyep Hashem has figured out at what time, at what place, at what hour, everything, when A will meet up with B, that everything is orchestrated from above. Our job is how to respond. Our job is to be able to take the ball and run with it and realize that Hashem is the one who's leading us down in this particular path. Just to share two stories that perhaps illustrate this on some level, what we're trying to say. Story number one happened about almost exactly 50 years ago at this time of year. It was a family living in Dayton, Ohio. So some of you may be acquainted with Dayton, Ohio. Dayton, Ohio, the Jewish community is much smaller than Columbus, Ohio. Columbus is much smaller than Cleveland in Cincinnati, and Cincinnati is smaller than Cleveland. So if you understood all of that, so then you know that even though there are beautiful communities in Columbus and in Cincinnati, growing, beautiful communities, they're small compared to, let's say, Cleveland, which is obviously smaller than New York, without giving gradations, just in terms of size and abilities and amount of Torah institutions. Now, go back 50 years. So 50 years ago, Dayton was, you know, like barely on the map in terms of Jewish. So it's a family with three little kids who are very happy in Dayton, Ohio. Father has worked, the mother has worked, involved in the community, they're living happily ever after. And then they realize that their oldest is getting to be of school age. And then they're faced with a very important question. There's a community day school in Dayton, or there was at least 50 years ago, and they could get a Jewish education. And obviously the education that you can get in Dayton, Ohio cannot be compared to education you get in New York. And the question that this couple asked themselves is, do we send their children to the community day school here, or do we try to offer them the best we can in terms of the Jewish education in New York, even though it's going to be a sacrifice for us in terms of lifestyle, in terms of being in a small town, etc., etc. And they made the decision to go to New York. I, being the middle child of these three children, can say 50 years later that that decision had ramification on now thousands of people. In my humble opinion, I wouldn't be where I am today had my basic Jewish education grown up in Dayton, Ohio, and not in the New York schools, the excellent schools that I was sent to. So this is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, he puts, obviously people have free choice, but certain ideas in people's heads and say, reevaluate, rethink. I need this person 50 years down the road. She's a little girl right now, but I need her 50 years down the road in a certain place and in a certain position. So therefore, we have to now orchestrate now this little girl to be able to go to certain schools that she can then form for me where I need her in the larger picture globally in the Jewish world 50 years from now. And this is what we're talking about, that God doesn't have past, present, or future. We're all these parts of a much larger picture, that every one of us is put where we need to be put, when we need to be put, in order to be able to do what we can do. And we have to recognize that we're not just living in our small little, you know, lives, that our lives impact a lot of other lives, and decisions we make impact many other decisions. The second is a story that I'm sure many of us here have read, so I'll repeat it because it's such a beautiful story and it warms the heart. And for those who haven't heard it, so you'll hear it for the first time. It was a story that was found in Mishpacha magazine, toward the beginning of the magazine, around the Pesach issue, before, right up of the Pesach issue on Mishpacha magazine in English. It was a great story. It was the story of a fellow in his early 40s who just lost his job as a computer programmer. And this is not the great part of the story. When you see the end, it's a great part of the story. The beginning starts very sad. And his wife was just a little later diagnosed, and he's coming back from Sloan Kettering, and he feels like his world has crashed down on him, which basically it had. And he's very distracted as he's driving, and he sideswipes another car, trying to switch lanes, not seeing, and they pull over, and he feels terrible, and he tells this guy, you know what, it's totally my fault. My wife's in the hospital, I lost my job, I'm like, you know, my life is falling apart. The guy says, like, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. He says, look, you know, I'm totally responsible, right? This firm guy says, I'm totally responsible. And he pulls out of his jacket pocket, you know, a random envelope. You know, like we all have in our pocketbooks random envelopes. Usually we have grocery lists on them. Sometimes we use them to write notes to our kids' teachers. Yeah, we know what we're talking about here. And we just make sure we cross off on the grocery list the final amount. Right, we've all done that, yeah? So anyway, back to the story. He pulls out an envelope and he writes his name and number, and he says, please assess the damage. And the other guy was Jewish, not religious, and I'll pay you. He gets a call the next day, and this fellow says, remember me? I'm the guy you bumped into yesterday. Yeah, how much do I owe you? He says, forget about how much you owe me. He says, I just found it fascinating. I Googled the envelope you gave me. You Googled what? You know the envelope you gave me? Tikkun Chachot. Tikkun Chachot. What are you talking about? You know the envelope you gave me? I don't know. Some random envelope. You know, we get stuck as, you know, people get stuck as all over in the mail. He says, I emailed it. It was very fascinating. These people are learning in the middle of the night. Oh, Tikkun Chachot. Yes. You could, you know, pay and sponsor people who are learning. He says, I found it so fascinating. He said, you should know, 10 o'clock this morning, I went online and I made a donation in honor that your wife should have a full recovery. While they're having this conversation, phone beeps in. It's a hospital, and the nurse introduces herself and says, my name is so-and-so. I'm calling from Sloan Kettering. He says, hold on a second. Are you by any chance related to, is the same last name of the guy he bumped into? She said, yeah, that's my husband. Okay. She said, I just want you to know, 10 o'clock this morning, we ran another set of scans on your wife, and everything's completely clean. You can come home, come back here, get your wife, everything is fine. And then, when he tells this guy this great news and thanks him for the donation, right? Stuff it to Atzilut Mavet. The guy says, by the way, you mentioned that you're a computer programmer. I own a business, computer programming, and I'm actually looking for somebody with exactly the expertise that you have, and he hires him for a job. Okay, so you'll say to me, man, that's a really dramatic story. It is a dramatic story, but I have a little secret to tell you, my friends. That's only because we see it. But as the Chazon Ish was saying is, everything here is nevuah. It's hester panim, granted, it's concealed. But when you see such hashgacha prati in front of your eyes, you realize there is another running the show, but the Ribono Shel Olam, only Hashem. And that's what the whole inyan of ribbons is about. Of the Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, we have to understand that it's not by accident. I have the money, I have the ability to lend. Everything is coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And on this level, why? Is it connected to Yetziat Mitzrayim? So the Maharal notes in source number 30 that really the fact that I can't take ribbons, Siftei Chaim quotes, it doesn't make any sense. It's Kabbalah's old. Kenenu Muvan in the bracket, Beshut Muvan B'Sechel Ha'Ata. It doesn't make any sense to me. Rather, it's Harei Mekabel Olo Shekodesh Baruch Hu. It's I'm accepting the yoke of God's kingship, which is what the whole inyan of leaving Egypt is about, that I understand. That even though things don't make sense to me, there is a divine providence that runs everything in this world. And that's one of the messages of leaving Egypt, that God is in control. Kabbalah's all, I take on the yoke, and I understand that I'm giving myself completely over to Hashem, even when it doesn't make sense, because it's only my limited understanding that makes no sense. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees the entire picture. So my friends, what we've seen so far is idea number one, I'm not allowed to charge interest because all my money comes from God. Idea number two, I'm not allowed to charge interest because Hashem wants me to be giving to this person at this particular time. This is part of the larger picture of what the give and take is all about that enables the world to run so smoothly. And that's the way Hashem gives our haras panim, our hashkacha. Hashem gives the beneficence to us through the giving and the receiving through the combination of both together. The final idea, and then we'll get to some practical examples, is Ben Adam La'atzma. Notes, Rosh Shirim in Source 32, people sometimes have a tendency that all of their thoughts, V'chol Hegiyav, Sovavim, Hochim, the asterisks in 32, Saviv Atzma. Everything a person does, it's about what can I get from it. Yeah, they'll help other people only in terms of what they're going to get from it. We have to learn how to give for the sake of giving, not what we can get. And giving, lending without interest is the perfect time where it's not about, well, let me, you know, set up the rate, 5% interest, 10%, whatever it is, 1%, no. It's not about what I'm getting. I need to be altruistic. I need to give for the sake of giving. The Sichus Musar calls the Shleimus HaMaisa, that we have to train ourselves to be able to do something in the fullest way possible where we step out of the picture. It's not about me. I happen to have money and I'm going to give it to you. It's training me that the world doesn't revolve around me and what can I get from it. You know, sometimes you have people who, when they're introduced to other people, what's going through their mind, either consciously or subconsciously, is, okay, what do they do? What can I get from them? How will they be useful for me in my life? Like, it's not about what I can give to them. It's about what I can get. Shleimus HaMaisa, Vatznei Aleche, is how can I do something where I am not the focus of attention, how I can do something in the best way possible. And one of the ways to be able to have this mindset to do this, notes Rav Wolbe in 39, is to look at the next person as a brother and not as a friend. When you talk about a family member, hopefully, you're not thinking about what can I get from it. With a family member, you just want to, you know, be there for that person. It's not about you. It's just helping. And that's why the Chumash uses the word achicha, your brother. The mindset you should have, again, helping physically and spiritually, is that this is my brother. It's not about me. It's about the other person. And that's the laws of ribbis is here to work on me as an individual, to be able to move myself away from myself and my vested interests and be able to see, what can I do for another with nothing to do with me? That's enabling me to grow as a person. And indeed, This is why it says, "V'yareta melokecha," you should fear God. Because God knows what's in your heart. God knows whether this is about, well, people are going to say I'm so magnanimous, and I'm such a giving person, and it's really good about you. Or are you really doing it, really under the radar? Somebody was just telling me that their father-in-law, who was just Nifter, was a tremendous Baal Tzedakah. He gave a lot of Tzedakah. And she once said to him, she says, you know, I don't see any plaques on your walls. Now, nothing against plaques, but she was just curious. Like, you're giving, like, a lot of money. And, like, where are the plaques? He says to her, I'm just a conduit. It's not about me. Right? That's the mindset that we need to have. Right? That's a person working on themselves. That's Hashem, who's able, Rashi brings down. Why? Rashi quotes the Gemara, which expands on the words of the Pasuk, I'm Hashem, brought you out from the land of Egypt. The Gemara says, when I took you out of Egypt, I distinguished between those who were firstborns and those who were not. I also know an exact punishment from those who lend money to his fellow Jew with interest and falsely claims that the money belongs to a Gentile. Hashem knows very well what your intentions are and how you're doing it and what loopholes you're using. And that's why this is the idea of MS, of truth. And first and foremost, you have to be truthful to yourself. And Rav Schwab notes here at the end of 37, he says, it's no wonder that after we mention Zechira Sitzia Mitzrayim, in the third paragraph of Shema, we end, Ani Hashem Elokechem Emes. Hashem is the God of truth. And this is what it's about, to be honest with ourselves. Who am I? What am I really trying to do? Is it to impress others? Is it to look good? Or is this is really, I want to be a magnanimous person for the sake of giving? And this is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who is very well aware of what we're thinking. My friends, we understand between man and God, all of our money comes from God. Between man and man, Hashem orchestrates every single situation in life and everything at perfect timing. And we're here to be givers. And Hashem wired us in certain places, in certain ways, for us to fulfill our mission. And finally, between man and self, we're here to be able to work on that egotistical part of ourselves to become more altruistic. How does Ribbis apply to our lives? So in the few minutes that we have left, I'd like to give some examples. And again, the disclaimer is this is not halacha, not at all to tell you if you're allowed to do this, if you're not allowed to do this. It's just bringing some ideas to the fore. There are the book that I know of in English, and there could be others. The classic book is called The Laws of Ribbis, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman. This is a very, very complicated book, very, very detailed book with tremendous, it's a halachic manual, really. And it goes through all the different ideas of mortgages and penalties, and it's very, I didn't understand the word of it, but it's very comprehensive. I think it's just because I never took Economics 101 in college. There's another book in Hebrew, which is called Ribit Brura. This one speaks a lot more to me, and mainly because it has pictures, and pictures is something that my intellectual level of complexity understands. And in both of these cases, and there are many other books out there, I'm sure, these are just two random ones, you see that there's a lot to talk about. So I want to bring up a couple of examples. The first one is Ribbis in terms of neighbors, right? Somebody borrows, you knock on your neighbor's door and you say, can I have half a cup of sugar? Can I have 3 eggs? Can I have some chairs? Whatever it is. So when you say, can I borrow, let's take the example, can I borrow a bottle of wine or a half a cup of sugar? So when I use the word borrow, so then I become the borrower and they become the lender. And then I have a relationship of a borrower-lender relationship. It may not be financial money, but it is over objects, which is also part of Ribbis. Now, in this, I have to be careful that whatever I return is not returned with interest, which means if I borrow a half a cup of sugar, so again, you don't have to sit with a measuring cup, this foreign saying, you know, it's exactly to the ounce. You can use your eyes to evaluate. It's a half a cup, and you return it, right? But you don't return a full cup of sugar. That would be ribbis. That would be interest. Likewise, it has to be basically the same grade. So if I borrow large eggs, then I can't return small eggs or medium eggs. It should be the same amount, because otherwise, again, we have problems of ribbons. Let's take another example. You borrow a bottle of wine, right? It's our Shabbos. Oh, I ran out of wine. Can I borrow a bottle of wine? And you borrow, a simple bottle of wine, $10 bottle of wine. And you feel so appreciative that they bailed you out. You want to give them a $30 bottle of wine. Again, that's ribbons. If you have to return back whatever you gave them. Now, again, it's obviously very complex. You have, let's say, somebody borrows a 5-pound bag in Israel of laundry detergent, 5 kilograms. You can't then return 5 1-kilogram bags, because a 5-kilogram bag is cheaper than 5 1-kilogram bags. So this is an example that even if you're returning the same amount, it has to also equal somewhat, within reason, the same price. So the example that he gives is if someone borrows a bottle of water in Yerushalayim and then they go to Meiron, you can't return that bottle of water in Meiron because the price of water in Meiron is much more expensive than the price of bottle of water in Yerushalayim. So again, this is much more complex than we even would imagine. Rabbi Reisman brings down in 44 that neighbors who have the relationship, that they're not really borrowing, they're gifting each other, and right? So then you don't have to worry about all these technicalities, half a cup of fun. We're talking about, you have to be careful when you go to a neighbor, you shouldn't say, can I borrow a half a cup of sugar? You should say, can I have a half a cup of sugar? If you want to give her back a half a cup of sugar, that's your prerogative. Once you use the word borrow, you've then entered into this borrowing, lending, ribbis relationship. And it applies as well, just making mention of this, to what we say. So if after anyone gives you or doesn't give you, you say, thank you so much, right? You knock on a neighbor's door, you say, can I have a half a cup of sugar? Half a cup of milk. I'm so sorry, I just ran out. You say, oh, thank you so much. You're so sweet. I appreciate everything you do. And you close the door. And then you go to another neighbor and, can I have a half a cup of sugar, half a cup of milk? And they give you and say, oh, thank you so much. You're so sweet. I appreciate everything you do. That's fine, because you're saying that to everybody. But if the first person who says, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have, you say, oh, thanks anyway, and you close the door. And then the second person gives you, and you say, oh, thank you so much. You're so kind. You're so considerate. That's ribbons. You've added more words than was necessary or that you were habituated to say. Right? There's a story of, I believe it was Rav Schwab, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was Rav Schwab, who once borrowed money from Rabbi Rucham to go home. And when he returned it, he said, thank you. He said, saying thank you is ribbis, it's extra. I guess boys don't say thank you. And then the next time he borrowed money, he didn't say thank you. Rabbi Yerucham said, how come you say thank you? He said, Rebbe, last time I said thank you, you said it was ribbis. He says, I understand that. He says, okay, you can't say thank you, but it has to be on your face that you wanted to say thank you, but you couldn't say thank you. I didn't see that thank you written all over you. Okay, so again, here we have this concept that even adding more than we normally do to words that we say may be an aspect of interest, of ribbis, which is something to think about. A classic, another case, which he explains differently than people understand. Sometimes people think they're being careful in ribbis when they don't have to be, which is part of not learning. Very often people will lend somebody their car. So then the person says, well, I didn't know if it was at a quarter of or a half a tank, so I didn't know how much to fill it up, and I hope that whatever is extra, I give you as a gift, and it's not ribbis. So he says clearly that when you lend a person a car, you're lending the car, not the gas. So since you're lending the car, not the gas, to fill up on the gas is not a problem of ribbis, because you didn't lend the gas, you lent the car. So again, these are things, considerations that we have to keep in mind. Let's take a look at another idea, 45. A business may not set two prices for the same item, where one price is charged for cash payments and a higher price is charged when the item is purchased on credit. This is because someone who pays the higher price is actually paying an additional fee for credit. This is ribbis. A customer who is faced with a situation permitted to make a cash purchase at a lower price, but may not purchase on credit. Moving down to 6, when the item which is being sold has a clear market value, some poskim hold that a two-tier price system is permitted as long as the credit price is set at the fair market value. In this case, a lower price sale may be set for cash customers. The reason for this leniency is that the credit customer is not being charged for credit. It's the cash customer who is being rewarded for paying cash. According to some poskim, this is permitted. Now, why this gets more complicated, and again, there's a lot to learn here, is let's say you do an advance payment on something, right? You give an advance payment for a refrigerator and it's not in stock, right? So then they're having the use of your money before you get the item. So that may be a potential problem and how you were able to work that problem. Sometimes you want to pay, and you want to pay, you know, in increments, and there's interest charged. The classic example that he gives here, today in 5, it's common practice for gas stations in the United States to charge a higher price when payment is paid by credit card. I have learned parenthetically is that doing anything the hard way, fill up your gas when you are renting a car way before the airport. I cannot believe what highway robbery, I'm talking about highway robbery, I'm talking about airport robbery. I mean, they're flying away with your money there. When you fill up, you know, you have to fill up your gas to give back sometimes the rent a car. Man, oh man. Okay, that's not our discussion for today. That was just getting off the trauma I've been through. Anyway, today it's common practice for gas stations in the United States to charge a higher price when payment is made by credit card. It is prohibited to buy gas on credit at the higher price from a station which is owned by a Jew. Let's take a look at the arrow. Regarding Israeli businesses which have similar arrangements, the gas station owner does not receive payment from the card company until later. In the interim, he's actually the one who is extending credit to the customer. Where the gas stations charge more for credit card purchases to offset the cost which they incur in connection with the processing of credit card slips, this is permitted. Unfortunately, the markup for credit purchases often exceeds the added cost to the company, and this is prohibited, which is what we began with. And it's not just charging interest, it's paying interest as well, which is a problem. And this is true sometimes of these Coke machines, right? That it'll be, you know, $5 for a Coke if you pay cash, and $6.50 if you pay for a credit card. Again, if it's owned by a Jew, you run into these problems. 46, it sometimes happens that an employer is unable to pay his employees' wages on time. When this happens, the employer may not offer his workers additional payment to induce them to agree to delay in receiving their pay. This prohibition is not limited to situations involving formal employment. When a youngster is hired to clean a yard or to babysit, the employer is also permitted from compensating him, even by giving a simple gift such as a candy, for being late with payment. This is just giving us a little bit of a taste to understand that there is a real responsibility of everything we do, we say, that every single penny of ours, right? This is a question also brought down, which I will discuss, that, you know, can you round off? I owe you $5.33. Can I round off and pay you $5.50? Or the extra money is ribbis. What to do with that extra money? These are all different examples where these laws, instead of rolling our eyes and saying, oh my gosh, which is what I had throughout this week when I was teaching this, like, this is, come on. Let's step back and say, maybe we're not familiar with this, and that's why it's difficult for us to wrap our heads around this. But, however, this is, again, teaching us that there is responsibility, that God has given us property, He's given us money, He's given us certain accountability, and that these are the laws that we have to understand, that this is making us more sensitive to the money that we have, more sensitive to the business relationships that we have. And it gives us a sense that things aren't random, that things have a place, that things have their correct place. And albeit they're complicated, these laws, and they may be strange and difficult for us, but the more that we learn them, even a little bit, one step at a time, slow and steady, when we start learning about it and it becomes part and parcel of who we are, then we say, oh, I see. This is about being careful. It's about not just being sloppy in my interpersonal relationship. And when I start being careful, I realize that, you know what? Not only do I have to be careful with the amount of food that I eat in a certain amount of time, right, in order to say a bracha, and I be careful what bracha I say, and be careful how I speak and what language I use. I also have to be careful with my money and how I use it and when I use it and to whom do I give it. And all of this is making us into greater and more spiritual people. Our challenge is to be able to take these laws and to be inspired by them, to be elevated by them. That will affect my relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. It will affect my sensitivity to others, and that situations aren't random. Even 50 years later, we see larger pictures and a certain sensitivity of truth and integrity to myself, that everything that I do and I say has meaning and accountability, and I want to try to rise to the best in each and every occasion.